Good afternoon, Tri-States. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. We are sponsored in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. This is Ken reading from the Friday, October 30th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. And now we take our first piece from Above the Fold, Area Investors Eye Bellevue for New Resort, a Dubuque area investment group with hopes of reeling people in to the area is now sizing up its latest project that could transform Bellevue's current event center and campgrounds into a riverside resort featuring an aquatic center and bar. During a recent Bellevue City Council meeting, members of Offshore Enterprises LLC spoke with council members about their interest in renovating the 49-acre parcel. The group hopes to establish a relationship with the city and receive financial assistance to recoup some of the money it plans to invest to complete the project, said City Council member Tim Roth. "It all sounds positive," he said. "They have got some great background in what they want to try to accomplish down here. Everything is preliminary right now." The investors hope to expand the campground from 65 campsites to hold more than 100 spots, add an aquatic center, which will include a 6,000-square-foot pool, 1-acre swim pond with a beach and bar, and additional plans include renovating the event center to accommodate about 450 guests and improving amenities at the current restaurant. Jamie Becker, who is part of the investment group who spoke to the Bellevue City Council, told the Telegraph Herald they are slated to close in November on a purchase agreement with A.J. Spiegel, the current owner of the Baymont Inn and Suites, Offshore Bar and Grill, and Offshore Event Center. She declined to provide any additional information until the agreement is finalized, but said they do plan to invest about $6 million to renovate and expand amenities at the site. Other members of the Offshore Enterprise LLC present during the council meeting include Kim Becker, A.J. Becker, Ryan Becker, Steve Lonsbach, Tracy Lonsbach, and Jason Germain. The city of Bellevue and their community have been absolutely amazing to work with us so thus far, Jamie Becker said in an email to the TH. This isn't the investment group's first go-round with developing a summertime resort along the Mississippi River. In 2018, many of the members included in Offshore Enterprises LLC opened Coconut Cove, a 40-acre resort in Hazel Green. They have also spearheaded transformations of the Dubuque Marina and Yardarm and Whitetail Bluff Campground in Cassville. Bellevue City Administrator Abby Skirschers said the investors plan to renovate the Bellevue facility, which has a beautiful riverfront location, into a tourist attraction similar to Coconut Grove. She said they commended Spiegel for his initial vision to develop in Bellevue. In 2007, Spiegel, who has also been a major player in growth throughout Piasta, purchased the property for $1.8 million and developed the land to build what is now the Baymont Inn and Suites, as well as the Offshore Bar and Grill and Offshore Event Center. But over time, Spiegel said he realized the project was too much for him to tackle alone. After being approached by Offshore Enterprises LLC, he agreed to sell the facility. "My initial interest was to make something happen in a nice way, and I could not do that myself," he said. "I really think they will do a good job because this is what they do." Skifshith said members of the investment group said they plan to begin work immediately and are hopeful to have the campground expanded by next May, with the Aquatic Center being the next project in line. The timing is beneficial for the fact that the city has a pool that is almost 60 years old. And in the past, the city went out for bond referendums and they failed twice, she said. We see it as we can do a private-public partnership, but we also see it as a way we can help our town. Our next piece has a large picture above the fold of a man holding up something, a stick or something, but he's looking into what appears to be a hatchery. He happens to also be masked. Northeast Regional Fishery Supervisor Mike Stook of the Iowa Department of Natural Resources checks on the brook trout being raised at the DNR Fish Hatchery in Manchester, Iowa. And her article is Hatcheries Spawn Interest from Manchester. The only three trout hatcheries in Iowa are located in the northeast region of the state, in Manchester, Elkader, and Decorah. The Manchester location, established in the 1890s, is the only one that both spawns and stocks trout for about 50 streams and 18 ponds for a 16-county region, and is a bit of an unlikely destination for visitors wanting to see something different. Mike Stook, Iowa Department of Natural Resources Northeast Regional Fisheries Supervisor, said the hatchery receives many visitors throughout the summer, but the prime time to come is when the property is bathed in red, oranges, and yellows. The best time to come is in the fall, when you're surrounded by all the fall colors, he said. Today, Wednesday, we'll probably get about 5 or 6 cars, but on the weekend, we'll get about 50 cars. Tom Allen of Manchester has fished in eastern Iowa streams since the 1950s. Allen said the hatchery gives people the unique opportunity to see how fish are raised, and the facility's visitors then benefit the entire Delaware County area. For eastern Iowa, it supplies the trout for the trout streams, which draws in the fishermen, which draws in the campers who spend their money here, Allen said. Local businesses around Manchester or New Vienna towns that are near the trout streams see an economic benefit, too. People can come to the fish hatchery from sunrise to sundown to walk among the raceways and ponds full of fish, Stoik said. However, indoor areas in which the spawning process happens have been closed to the public for months due to COVID-19. Hatching and raising fish is so specialized, so I wanted to isolate my staff as much as possible, Stoik said. Because if one of them got sick, the rest of us are not as good at taking care of the fish. Typically, school and family tours walk through the buildings in which tens of thousands of brown, brook, and rainbow trout eggs are fertilized, he said. Stoik has a display he shows tours of each stage of a trout's growth from egg to fingerling, the stage when a fish is about the size of a finger. Through the Iowa DNR Hatchery Program, Stoik said about 170,000 fingerlings are stocked in streams annually in order to grow naturally. The DNR program also stocks about 330,000 trout at a catchable size, which is around a half pound in weight. Trout typically reach that point after being fed twice per day for 15 months, Stoik said. We usually have fish food in little cups people could pick up, but we stopped that because we thought people would congregate, Stoik said. It's really fun to feed the fish. It really sucks we can't have the public come feed them. They're usually swirl together and splash up. However, people still can come to see the swarms of yet-to-be-stocked trout outdoors. The trout stay in ponds and raceways pumped full of 55-degree groundwater year-round, so the fish are consistently kept in optimal conditions for growth. Some of the biggest fish that can be seen are nearly the length of an arm, and Stoik said those stay well-fed at the hatchery for 3 to 5 years in order to spawn. Occasionally, Stoik added that kids eager to see the large fish have fallen into the pond. However, the water is shallow enough to not present much danger before they are pulled out. Anglers also can fish at Spring Branch Creek, which runs for a mile through the hatchery's property, while neighboring states like Wisconsin and Minnesota pause trout fishing for a period each year in order to spawn more fish, Stoick said people can fish for trout in Iowa at any time. We haven't seen impacts to our population, so we keep it open, he said. Plenty of visitors also come out to picnic, he said, though the hatchery doesn't track how many visitors come. The hatchery has a gazebo that people enjoy, and Stoick noted he often takes his family there for Mother's Day. Stoick also said people enjoy biking and viewing the waterfall at the Decorah Fish Hatchery, and the Big Spring Trout Hatchery in Elkader is popular with those wanting to fish in the Turkey River. Gary Siegworth, manager of the Big Spring Hatchery, said the rustic campground near the hatchery also provides the unique opportunity to camp right on the banks of the Turkey River. Additionally, the Elkader facility has a kids-only fishing pond on site that's popular with visitors, though the pond and other outdoor activities soon will be closed until April. An increased number of visitors to the hatchery was witnessed this summer as people turned to outdoor activities due to the pandemic, Siegworth added. A lot more people showed up on the Turkey River, he said. We saw it at the trout streams we stock, too. Places that don't see a lot of fishing had worn down paths. Our final front page piece, schools strive to stay connected with parents. And we have a small inset picture of a teacher looking at some of the things on her computer. Second grade teacher Angela Buddy conducts a virtual parent-teacher conference Thursday in her classroom at Carver Elementary School in Dubuque. Parent-teacher conferences took on a particular level of importance this fall for the staff at George Washington Middle School in Dubuque. Typically, parents have the chance to visit in the school for open houses, concerts, and sporting events. During the COVID-19 pandemic, however, opportunities to visit the school have been limited. There's not as much of the physical interaction with parents that we would normally have up to this point in the year, so I think it's even more important to use that conference time to build those relationships with parents, Principal Brian Howes said. The pandemic has forced local school districts to get creative about finding ways to help parents feel connected to their children's education, local officials said. Though many of their usual opportunities to interact with parents have been altered, they say stay connecting with families remains key. Student academic success, both socially and educationally, is really dependent on the strong community, school, student, and family relationships, said Angela Barth, principal of Southwestern Wisconsin Elementary School in Hazel Green. In situations like this, it causes districts, not only in Southwestern, but also the nation, to be creative in how you sustain those relationships. Staff at Carver Elementary School in Dubuque recently wrapped up their fall conferences, most of which were held virtually. Parents were given the option to request an in-person meeting or a phone call, but about 80% of them opted to attend conferences via Zoom, Principal Andy Peterson said. The format of virtual conferences was similar to previous years. Teachers sent their students home with assessment results and information for parents to refer to during conferences. The reaction has been overwhelmingly really positive, so I do still feel like we're making those connects in the different format, Peterson said. At Washington, staff altered their parent-teacher conferences to better suit a virtual format. Typically, parents would visit with each of their children's teachers for a few minutes. This fall, they met with one teacher who had compiled comments from their children's instructors. Instead of like 4 or 5 minutes with every teacher, they're spending about 20 minutes with one teacher and kind of going in-depth, Howes said. In the Western Dubuque Community School District, elementary school conferences are being held largely virtually. Middle and high school staff aren't holding traditional conferences, but instead they are sending out communications to families explaining what they are doing in class, said Kelly Simon, the district's director of curriculum, instruction, and assessment. In many ways, the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted the ways in which parents typically connect and get involved with the schools. At Resurrection Elementary School in Dubuque, parents often visit the school to volunteer or for events such as the Halloween dance or the book fair. This fall, parents are not allowed in the building during the school day, though some were able to volunteer at the school walkathon. We love those opportunities, and we just can't offer very many of them this year, Principal Denise Grant said. Instead, Grant has been active on the school's Parent Association Facebook page, posting photos of things happening at school. She and her staff also use other forms of communication to reach out to families with updates on the school and information on assignments and activities. They are also tried to find new ways of holding some activities, such as hosting a virtual Grandparents' Day. We're trying to offer the same things, but it just looks different because those things are so important, Grant said. Simon, likewise, said that because schools are not holding many typical events that parents would attend, staff are increasing their outreach to families by sharing on social media, offering virtual open houses, and trying out other opportunities, such as a virtual Halloween parade for pre-kindergartners. If we sat back and just said, well, it's COVID, so we can't, it would be absolutely detrimental to our home family connection, Simon said. Instead, we are trying to use this as an opportunity to increase their usage of our social media platforms. Angela Buddy, a second grade teacher at Carver, is sending home plenty of written communication, photographs, and documents. I think there is probably more communication going back and forth between home and school than maybe we would have had before, she said. Maybe that's out of necessity, but also us wanting everybody to feel really connected. Alicia Ellerbeck has two children at Carver who are both learning entirely virtually this fall. Though her children aren't physically in the school building, she still can connect with their teachers via email and Zoom, and she receives emails daily on their progress. We feel like we're really connected, almost probably more connected with their teachers than we would be if we were in school, she said. And now we turn to some news from Dubuque and the tri-states, and we have our most recent COVID update. 2 deaths, 71 new virus cases in Grant County. Grant County, Wisconsin reported 2 more COVID-19-related deaths Thursday, and Dubuque County's death toll went back up to 58. That's 58th death had been reported by the state on Tuesday, but the county's tally fell back to 57 on Wednesday before moving back up Thursday. Dubuque County reported 108 new cases between 5 p.m. Wednesday and 5 p.m. Thursday, pushing its total to 5,476. The state reported 231 individuals tested during that time frame. The state reported 14-day positivity rate for Dubuque County was 16.4% as of 5 p.m. Thursday. Jackson County reported 24 new cases in the 24-hour period that ended 5 p.m. Thursday, with a state-reported 14-day positivity rate of 20.1%. Jones County had 22 new cases in that time span, and its state-reported 14-day rate climbed to 12.7%. Delaware County had 12 new cases as of 5 p.m. Thursday. Its rate of 22% was the third highest of the state's 99 counties. Clayton County added 6 cases, and the state shows a 14-day positivity rate of 14.7%. By subtracting the number of related deaths and recovered in Dubuque County from the number of confirmed cases, There were 1,828 active cases as of 5 p.m. Thursday, an increase of 34 over the 24 hours earlier. The state on Thursday reported county-level hospitalization numbers as of Wednesday, which include Dubuque County 30, an increase of 6 over Tuesday's list, Jackson County 7, Delaware County 5, Clayton County 6, an increase of 3, and Jones County 2. Iowa continues to report outbreaks in 5 area long-term care centers. As of 5 p.m. Thursday, Luther Manor Communities in Dubuque had an additional case, pushing its tally to 45 with 8 recovered. Totals were unchanged at Edgewood Convalescent Home, which has 5 total cases. Good Neighbor Home in Manchester, 81. Mercy One Dyersville Senior Care, 35. And Sunnycrest Manor in Dubuque, 20. Iowa's statewide confirmed caseload grew by 2,363 cases during the 24-hour span, reaching 119,991 as of 5 p.m. Thursday. The related death toll increased by 13, rising to 1,695. Our second piece from the tri-state area. After cost-cutting, Platteville faces smaller tax hike. Attempting to address concerns that property owners are facing financial hardships during the COVID-19 pandemic, Platteville leaders have reduced the proposed tax rate increase in the 2021 budget. City staff nearly halved the proposed rate increase from 3.2% to 1.7%, reducing tax revenues by $67,000. "We are very cognizant of what is happening to our residents," said City Manager Adam Ruschel. "The $19.8 million budget is dramatically inflated from the current fiscal year due to large construction projects, many of which are funded by grants. It includes a tax rate increase from $7.88 per $1,000 of assessed valuation to $8.02. Owners of a residential property assessed at $150,000 would pay about $1,203 in city property taxes, a $21 increase from 2019. Common Council members reviewed other budgetary changes during a meeting this week. It includes a 1% wage increase for staff and police, a cost increase of $25,000, but no raise for Ruschel. A previous proposal included a 1.5% wage increase. Additional personnel expenses derive from the proposed hiring of a human resources specialist at a cost of $62,000 and increasing the city's 30-hour communication specialist to full-time at a cost of $17,000. Council member Eileen Nichols believed the hire is necessary due to the increased workload that has been placed on staff shoulders during the pandemic and rising operational costs generally. "No one wants to hear there will be an increase in the mill rate," she added. "Like any business, which is really what the city is, our expenses are going up." But council member Ken Killian remains unconvinced that the HR position is necessary, stating that he has not received sufficient justification. "I think to come out and say we're going to hire another person at $62,000 when some people don't have good-paying jobs is a hard sell," he said. Ruschel explained that staff, particularly those in the finance department, handle HR duties, reducing the time they have to attend to their primary responsibilities. "Property owners also will face an increase in sewer rates from $4.75 per cubic foot to $4.91 due to take effect on January 15th. Councilmember Kathy Kopp said she appreciates the proposed reduction but remains concerned that the city still has proposed a tax increase. She said 2020 has been such a wild ride. We don't know how things are going to end up. I know it's been extremely challenging for businesses in particular. council members will hold a public budget hearing on November 24th before voting whether to approve it. Now we'll turn to our opinion page and we'll begin with our view, the editorial opinion of the Telegraph Herald's editorial board. And today's view, let's, as a nation, forget about setting clocks ahead back. This weekend, most Americans will get just what they didn't want, an extra hour of 2020. Yes, November 1st marks the annual occasion in which we all try to remember how to reset the clock on our vehicle's dashboard, the microwave, the coffee maker, the stove, and every other device that doesn't automatically update. It's time to fall back, as they say. Daylight saving time is about to end, setting off our biannual changing of the clocks ritual. All across the land, people will ask themselves, why do we do this again? It's a good question. New studies suggest that beyond being a change without much positive impact, messing with our sleep cycles is a downright bad idea. What if we just opted out of daylight savings time? Alternately, we could stick with so-called daylight saving time all the time and never go back to regular time. Either way, what if we just stopped switching back and forth? Daylight saving time is, after all, something of a myth. There really isn't any saving of daylight. We just move the time of day a little bit so we might enjoy more time outdoors before sunset, which, if you like that, would be a vote for springing forward and then never falling back again the first Sunday of November. It would be one thing if there were economic or energy savings in daylight saving time, but there is none. In 2005, before daylight saving time was extended by 3 weeks to save more of whatever it is we're supposed to be saving, the Department of Energy released a detailed report. Department of Energy officials noted that while people use less energy, household lights, when there's evening daylight, exactly the same amount of daylight was pulled from the morning, requiring more household lighting then. Aren't government workers smart? But Congress was enamored of the idea and went ahead and extended it anyway. So here we are, plodding along through another change of the clocks, even though it saves no daylight and no energy. Even worse, daylight saving time isn't a zero-sum game. The impact can be seen in all sorts of circumstances, and the effects are always detrimental. Largely related to the disruption is the sleep cycle. The concerns raised are so great, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine last month called for ending the practice of moving clocks forward and back. The Academy's research showed serious health risks associated with the time change transition, including increased prevalence of adverse cardiovascular events, mood disorders, and motor vehicle crashes. A study at the University of Colorado Boulder found vehicular fatalities increased by nearly 6% during week of the time change in spring when we lose an hour of sleep. Medical errors was another factor the American Academy of Sleep Medicine pointed toward, noting an 18% uptick of such errors during the same time span. A study by the Journal of Neuroscience, Psychology, and Economics found a strong correlation between the time shift and students scoring lower on standardized tests. It's time for federal legislation to end this practice. The European Parliament in 2019 voted to abolish daylight savings, but the pandemic has put implementation of the proposal on hold. Some 32 states in the U.S. have proposed similar legislation. It would have been nice had Congress acted on this before now. No one would complain about one less hour of 2020. Here's hoping for change in 2021. And we also have three letters to the editor. Our first one, Hinson Cares About Rural Recovery, from Mike Naig, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture. As Iowans prepare to head to the polls on November 3rd, many across our communities are still reeling from unprecedented challenges resulting from the pandemic and the derecho. Now, more than ever, leadership matters. We need voices in D.C. who are ready and equipped to respond to these challenges. This is why I'm encouraging Iowans throughout Iowa's 1st Congressional District to support Ashley Hinson for Congress. We need leadership that lifts up and empowers our farmers and ag sector during challenging times, not ones who rely on heavy-handed regulatory approaches that crush the ability of our farm communities to prosper. I've visited operations and businesses with Hinson, and I'm impressed with her willingness to listen, ask questions, and turn that feedback into effective policy positions Iowans need right now. This is what Hinson did during her time at the State House, where she supported expanding broadband that directly helped our rural communities. Hinson voted for the largest tax cut in Iowa history, while Congresswoman Finkenauer voted against that plan. While Hinson was in the legislature, she was part of a majority that prioritized fiscal responsibility and helped place Iowa in a position to help weather this downturn. In fact, we closed the 2020 budget year with a $305.5 million surplus. That doesn't happen by accident. I am proud to support Ashley Hinson for Congress, and I ask Iowans who care deeply about our rural recovery and growth to join me this November. Our second editorial, a letter to the editor. Baker, a known quantity who works hard. From Pete Bushman, Delaware County Board of Supervisors. Dave is an effective leader. This letter is in support of Dave Baker for Dubuque County Supervisor. We have worked with Dave on many occasions over the past 4 years, serving on various boards and committees, and have found him to be thoughtful and thorough in his examination of the facts. He rarely misses a meeting and is not afraid to ask the hard questions. Most importantly, his focus has always been for the benefit of the people of Dubuque County, and it has been a pleasure to serve with him. Dave's opponent may be a fine and capable person, but Dave is a known quantity, and we would urge you to support him in the upcoming election. Written on behalf of Delaware County Supervisors Pete Bushman, Jeff Madlam, and Shirley Helmix. And our third and final letter to the editor, exercise your right and vote now. From Charlotte Nieces, Mud Lake Road, Dubuque. We need to get out and vote if we want to change our current situation. It's probably too late to mail in absentee ballots, but it couldn't be easier to drop them off at the Dubuque County Courthouse. There is a ballot collection box behind the courthouse that you can drive up to and drop in your ballot. Please don't take anything for granted. We need every single ballot. When people try to take away our right to vote, we must try even harder to exercise our right to vote. Too many of our fathers, sons, and daughters have died fighting for our rights. Do them the honor of exercising that vote. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. We are listening to the Friday edition, Friday, October 30th edition of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. IRIS is supported in part by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation, and I'm Ken, your reader for the day. Now we will turn to today's obituaries. Shirley A. Pins from Dyersville. Shirley A. Pins, 90, of Dyersville, passed away Monday, October 26th, surrounded by family at her home. Visitation will be held 9 to 10:30 a.m. Monday, November 2nd, at Kramer Funeral Home in Dyersville, prior to funeral services. A massive Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Monday, November 2nd, at St. Francis Xavier Basilica, Dyersville, with burial in the church cemetery. Reverend Herb Pins will officiate and Deacon Roger Riesberg will assist. Shirley was born September 7, 1930, in Dubuque, the daughter of Mark and Rose McFarland Anglin Sr. She married William R. Dunn on September 19, 1953. They had three children, Kevin, Karen, and Stephen. William died October 5, 1959. Shirley later married George A. Pins February 10, 1962. They moved to Dyersville and had two children, Gregory and Patricia. She attended St. Joseph's Academy in Dubuque and then went on to become a registered nurse at Mercy School of Nursing. She graduated in 1951. She began working in Evanston, Illinois, and later at Mercy Hospital in Dubuque. Shirley was one of the original nurses at the Dyersville Community Hospital, where she worked until she retired. Online condolences may be left for the family at www.cramerfuneral.com. Shirley loved to crochet, bake, play cards, make puzzles, and play bingo with her friends. She always had time to play one more game with the grandkids before going home. Anna M. Brown. Anna May Brown, 88, of Dubuque, passed away Wednesday, October 28th at Ennoble Manor. Visitation will be from 3 to 5 p.m. Sunday, November 1st at Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 John F. Kennedy Road. Dubuque services will be held at 5 p.m. Sunday at the funeral home and will be live streamed on the Eaglehoff Siegert and Casper Funeral Home Facebook page. Private interment will be in the Mount Calvary Cemetery. Condolences and memories may be shared with the family at www.eaglehoffsiegertcasper.com. Anna was born May 10, 1932, in East Dubuque, Illinois, the daughter of Matthew J. and Stella F. Klein Timmerman. Anna was the manager of the shoe department at Woolworth's for 14 years and then was employed in sales at Electrolux for 13 years. She was a devoted homemaker and she cherished her two granddaughters. A hard worker, she continued to work part-time until she was 80. Anna was a member of Sacred Heart Catholic Church, where she sang in the choir. She also enjoyed country line dancing. Carol J. Vogel. Carol J. Bradbury Vogel, 64, of Fort Atkinson, Wisconsin, passed away Wednesday, October 28th, at her home. Carol was born October 20th, 1956, daughter of Calvin and Diane Mers Bradbury in Dubuque. She married Gary Vogel in Jefferson, Wisconsin, September 17, 1973. Carol had worked as a cook at UW-Whitewater for many years. Carol was a wonderful wife, daughter, mother, grandmother, and sister with the biggest hearts. Visitation will be held from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Tuesday, November 3rd, at Dunlap Memorial Home in Fort Atkinson. Graveside services will immediately follow at Evergreen Cemetery in Fort Atkinson. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be made to the family. Until we meet again, the special memories my daughters and I have will always bring a smile to our face. If we could only have you back just for a while, then we could sit and talk and play games like we used to do. You will always mean so much to Desiree, Chloe, and I, and always will. The fact that you're not here is breaking my heart, but I can't be selfish. I know you are no longer suffering. Me and my girls will forever be grateful to all you did in our lives. Until we meet again, love you always and forever, Stacy, Desiree, and Chloe. Mildred G. Finzel. Mildred G. Millie Finzel, 96, of Dubuque, died Tuesday, October 27th. Visitation will be from 2 to 4 p.m. Sunday, November 1st at Bear Funeral Home, 1491 Main. Services will be at 10:30 a.m. Monday, November 2nd at St. John the Baptist Church in Piasta. burial will be in St. John the Baptist Cemetery, Centralia. Marion L. Fahey. Marion L. Fahey, 92, of Dubuque, died Wednesday, October 28th. There will be no public visitation or service. A private family burial will be held at Mount Olivet Cemetery. A full obituary will run in Sunday's edition of the Telegraph Herald. Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory is assisting the family. Stephen E. Hudrick, Andrew. Stephen E. Hudrick, 65, of Andrew, died Wednesday, October 28th. Visitation will take place from 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, November 2nd at Carson Celebration of Life Center in Maquoketa. A graveside service and burial will be at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, November 3rd, St. John Cemetery in Andrew. Kevin Kiefer, Galena. Kevin Kiefer, 52, of Galena, died Thursday, October 29th at his home. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. View Furlong Funeral Chapel of Galena is assisting the family. Though we may be saddened by the passings of those who have touched our lives, we must also never forget we have new ones that arrive, sometimes on a daily basis. And here we have the ones from earlier this week. Monday, October 26th, Duffy, Mark and Courtney Duffy of Monticello, Iowa, a boy at Unity Point Health Findlay Hospital, Dubuque. Tuesday, October 27th, Heffler, Nicholas and Jordan Heffler of Piasta, a boy at Findlay. Wednesday, October 28th, Dressler, Kyle and Stephanie Dressler of Cuba City, a girl at Findlay. Welcome aboard, all you little ones, and may we rejoice in your arrival. Now, we do have one piece on this page that is of importance to us under the news in brief. Election advisory reminds voters of ballot submission deadlines. Dubuque County has issued an election advisory reminding voters of deadlines for submission of ballots. Ballots can be returned to the Dubuque County Election Office until 9 p.m. on Election Day, and that's Tuesday, November 3rd, according to a press release. Ballots returned by mail must have a postmark of no later than Monday, November 2nd. So it can't be on Tuesday. Monday, November 2nd. Ballots returned by mail and received by the election office no later than noon Monday, November 9th, will have the postmark date verified by barcode, according to the release. Voters also are reminded to sign the return envelope on ballots. So that might sound confusing, but what I think what they're saying is, depends on where you're at, you could put it in the mail and have it postmarked by the 2nd as it has to be, but it might take a few more days to get there by the 9th, you get until the 9th. But they'll still send the barcode through and they can tell when it was postmarked. So all of you, if you haven't got your ballots out there, you know by now what's going on. Get them done. Get them in there. Take them down to the courthouse. You can just drive up. Have friends take them in. Make sure you sign them. But vote, vote, vote. It is the one right, the inalienable right, one of many, that we have to exercise in a democratic republic. So I urge you, go out and vote. I'll continue now with some tri-state news, but this one is from Dubuque. It's Dubuque Museum's machine shop is operational. We see a large picture of a man bent over some machinery and another small picture of some machinery. It says, John Bowditch, historical machinery consultant, installs a historically correct cutting tool onto an 1860 lathe in the belt-driven machine shop within the River of Innovation exhibit at National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium in Dubuque. The coronavirus pandemic halted the originally scheduled ribbon-cutting ceremony, but it hasn't stilled the turning wheels of the centerpiece of a Dubuque Machine Museum's latest attraction. An operational 19th century belt-driven machine shop is at the center of the completed first phase of the $3 million, 9,000 square foot River of Innovation exhibit at the National Mississippi River Museum and Aquarium. A ribbon-cutting ceremony for the shop, located in the Fred W. Woodward Riverboat Museum portion of the museum campus, had been set for late March. The coronavirus pandemic forced the cancellation of that event and closed the museum entirely for about 10 weeks. The rescheduled ribbon-cutting ceremony for the Iowa Machine Engine and Launch Works segment of the River of Innovation will be held at 6 p.m. Friday, November 6th. The museum has started work on the second and final phase of the project. Innovation Currents and a makerspace will finish out the additional 6,000 square feet of the exhibit. There will be hands-on offerings focusing on four major themes pertaining to innovation in and around Dubuque, around the river: energy in motion, vehicles and cargo, tools and machines, and the changing river. Also featured will be the maker space, a space for anyone to come and tinker and play. That phase is expected to be completed by the summer of 2021. John Bowditch is a Cleveland, Wisconsin historical consultant helping the museum display and interpret the machine shop for visitors. He was back in Dubuque this week to work with the facility's education staff. He said the machine shop, consisting of contents of Bellevue's Iowa Machine, Marine Engine and Launch Works, is unique. "It's almost to the vanishing point," he said. "There have been plenty of machines that have been collected by museums or others, but they don't have the completeness of this shop. All of this machinery was used together, the same as it was, which makes it unusual." Donated to the museum in 2013 by Bellevue's Brandt family, the equipment dates from the 1850s to around 1910s. Workers relocated the ornate equipment to the museum in September 2018. And now I'll continue with news in brief. We have it scattered throughout our Dubuque and Tri-State sections. Let me begin on the Tri-State page. Marion man arrested, charged in Delaware County attack, from Manchester. A man recently was arrested in relation to a September assault that left a rural Manchester resident badly beaten and with a fractured ankle. Cody J. Clark, 25, of Marion, is charged in Iowa District Court of Delaware County with willful injury causing serious injury and possession of marijuana. Court documents state that two men assaulted Dustin W. Wall of rural Manchester at about 8:20 p.m. September 4th near his goat barn at his residence. Dustin had multiple serious injuries, including extensive swelling and bruising to his face, cuts on the back of his head, and a fractured ankle, documents state. During the ensuing investigation, Clark admitted he was one of the attackers, documents state. No information was provided on the second attacker, and it is unclear if anyone else has been arrested in the case. While executing a search warrant in connection with the case, marijuana was found in a truck that Clark also later admitted was his. A warrant in connection to the charges was issued on September 22nd. Southwest Wisconsin School District to move to virtual learning. Coming out of Livingston, Wisconsin. Iowa Grant School District will move to virtual learning for the week following Thanksgiving, from November 30th to December 4th. The district is taking the step as a precaution due to the congregation of families during the holiday, according to an online announcement. Iowa Grant is very committed to continuing to provide as much in-person instruction as possible, it stated. With this end goal in mind, the Ad Hoc Reopening Committee developed a proactive plan to reduce the impact of Thanksgiving gatherings. The pattern that we have observed is that a couple of days after people congregate, someone gets identified as COVID-19 positive and close contacts are made aware. The announcement states that the district plans to return to in-person classes on December 7th. Guttenberg City Hall closing to public due to virus. from Guttenberg. Guttenberg City Hall will be closed to the public due to an increase in COVID-19 cases in the area. All businesses will be conducted by phone, email, or online, the city announced. In-person meetings must be made by appointment. The announcement states that the closure will remain in effect until the number of new COVID-19 cases starts to decline. Clayton County has had about 95 new cases confirmed in the past week. Call 563-252-1161 and visit cityofguttenbergia.gov for more information. Now coming back to news in brief, a little closer to our Dubuque area. Police: man accused of assaulting girlfriend arrested after standoff. Police said a man accused of assaulting his girlfriend and threatening her with a butcher knife was arrested Thursday in Dubuque. Bryant J. Jackson, 42, of 583 Arlington Street, No. 1, was arrested at 7:39 a.m. Thursday at his residence on charges of domestic assault, impeding airflow, domestic assault while displaying a dangerous weapon, first-degree harassment, and obstruction of emergency communication. Court documents state that Monet J. Jones, 27, reported that Jackson woke her up at about 4 a.m., and they started arguing, at which point Jackson threatened to kill her. He started punching her and at one point threw her to the ground and choked her. When Jones fought off Jackson, he ran to the kitchen, returned with a 12-inch knife, and held it up to her throat. Jones advised that she was afraid he was going to use the knife on her, but he then threw the knife down and began punching her about her head and body again, documents state. She fought him off again, fled out of the residence, and tried to call 911, but he took the phone, continued punching her, and again knocked her to the ground and choked her. He then grabbed her by the hair and tried to drag her into the residence while she screamed for help, documents state. She then broke free and ran to the residence of a neighbor who called 911. Jackson remained inside his residence and refused to come out. Lieutenant Ted McClellan said, "Anytime we have a case like this, we set up a perimeter around the residence to make sure no one exits." McClellan said officers received a search warrant to gain access to the residence and arrested Jackson. Fire destroys apartment, displaces residents. Coming from Cascade. A fire destroyed an apartment, displaced residents, and caused about $100,000 worth of damage Wednesday night in Cascade. The fire at Clada Court Apartments, 506 6th Avenue Northwest, was contained to apartment number 10, but smoke entered nearby units, according to Cascade Fire Chief Denny Green. No one was injured. Firefighters were dispatched to the apartment of Kenneth Arndt at about 9:10 p.m. Wednesday and remained on scene until 11:20 p.m. Green said Arndt's apartment was destroyed. About a dozen other residents were at least temporarily displaced until their units were ventilated and had electricity restored. American Red Cross spokesman Josh Murray said his organization provided temporary lodging to two residents of the apartment complex. "We are following up today to see if they will need additional nights of lodging," Murray said. The Dubuque County Sheriff's Department issued a press release that said the fire caused about $100,000 in damage. An electrical issue was suspected as the cause of the fire, which was not considered suspicious, according to the Sheriff's Department. Bernard and Farley Fire Departments also assisted at the scene. And we'll finish off with our weekend buzz very quickly. The things that are noteworthy to do this weekend: the Dubuque Halloween Comic and Toy Show, QuadCon 2020, Saturday, Five Flag Center, 405 Main, from 10 until 4. Rocky Horror Picture Show, today and Saturday, the Grand Opera House, 135 West 8th Street, 7 p.m. and midnight. This is the cult classic musical. It's going to be shown with prop bags available to purchase. Dubuque Farmers Market, Saturday the 11th, 13th, and Iowa Streets. 8 a.m. to noon. Shop local produce and other items for the final outdoor Dubuque Farmers Market. Trick or treating. Today and Saturday, many tri-state communities will host trick or treating from today and Saturday in the city of Dubuque. It will run from 5:30 to 7 Saturday, October 31st. Other communities very quickly on Saturday include in Iowa, Bellevue, 4 to 6 p.m., Cascade, 4 to 5:30, Dyersville, 5 to 7, Guttenberg, 4:30 to 6:30, Manchester, 5 to 7, Maquoketa, 5 to 7, Piasta, 6 to 7:30. In Illinois, East Dubuque, 4 to 6, Wisconsin, Cuba City, 4:30 to 6:30, Darlington, 4 to 5:30, Fenimore, 3 to 6, Hazel Green, 4:30 to 6, Lancaster, 3 to 6, Platteville, 3 to 7, Potosi, 4 to 6, Shelbsburg, 6 to 8. Wow, that's a lot of them. Well, my dear listeners, that brings us to the end of today's reading, the Friday, October 30th reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald, brought to you by IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading and Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped, supported in large measure by DuPaco and the R.W. Hafer Foundation. If you have any kind of comments you'd like to make to us, I do have the phone number finally. You can call us 877-404-4747. As always, I enjoy my readings with you. This is Ken, the regular reader here. I enjoy reading with you, and I wish you the finest weekend ahead. Be careful out there if you venture out. And until next week, just take care. Bye-bye.